Thank you for joining us. The Governor's Update is scheduled to begin any moment now, and we will be following along, bringing you any important developments as they happen. Today on Voice of the Public, Dr. Dolores Gomez, the Chief Medical Officer for Memorial Medical Center, will join us to talk about how the local medical community is dealing with the surge in coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Yesterday, state health officials reported another record day of new coronavirus cases with 1,753, as well as 18 more deaths. Today, El Paso health officials reported 1,488 new cases and 16 deaths there. Your questions are welcome. Call 575-646-2212 for Voice of the Public from KRWG Public Media. We'll get started right after NPR News. Good afternoon. It is 1:06. Welcome to Voice of the Public on this Friday the 13th. At KRWG Public Media. This is KC Counts, and we are monitoring the governor's weekly update as we take your questions and talk with Chief Medical Officer Dr. Dolores Gomez from Memorial Medical Center. So far, and we mentioned just a few minutes ago, yesterday's new daily record of COVID cases reported at 1,753. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham called those numbers a disaster and said hospitalizations are up 214% over the last month. She says this cannot continue. But in the meantime, how is the local medical community dealing with this surge in cases and hospitalizations and, sadly, deaths? Dr. Dolores Gomez, welcome back to Voice of the Public, and thank you for taking some time out to join us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity again.
Well, let's start with what you're seeing there at Memorial Medical Center and how the hospital is handling this new surge in cases.
Well, sure. I wish I could bring forth some great tidings on how things are going. We are definitely, like you said, in our surge right now here in Las Cruces, where we would have maybe a handful of COVID cases during the summer months. We're now kind of averaging between about 40 to 50 COVID patients a day in our facility. I think Mountain View is also pretty similar with theirs as well. And unfortunately, some of them are taking up a good majority of our ICU beds. Our COVID patients right now are making up about a third of our admissions right now.
And we understand that there has been a mobile morgue now brought to the hospital and set up. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's in El Paso that's been a lot on the news lately about needing these additional refrigerated trucks. Our morgues here in Las Cruces are at capacity, and of course within the hospital we each have our own locations within the facility that allow us to have bodies when they have passed. And it's just as a preparation to have that ready for us, because if we continue to see the numbers as they're going right now, we know that that unfortunately equals an increased number of deaths. And where our morgues are right now, they're at capacity, so we have to have the ability to have these bodies someplace safe.
575-646-2212. We invite your questions for Dr. Gomez today on Voice of the Public. Please call and be a part of Voice of the Public here at KRWG. As I said, we're monitoring the governor's news conference as it is happening. And she did say we are in a life or death situation. And beginning Monday, for 2 weeks, New Mexicans are instructed to shelter in place. Trips should only be conducted for health, safety, and welfare. All non-essential businesses and nonprofits must cease in-person activities. Is this something that you were expecting, hoping for, Dr. Gomez?
It's not something that I wish we would have to do, but I think it's absolutely necessary right now. The hospitals are We're not at capacity, but if we keep moving in this direction, the trajectory that we're seeing of the number of hospitalizations required, we are going to run out of beds. We are going to have staff that can't keep up with the number of admissions, and we just don't want to have to deal with the idea of not being able to take care of these patients because we don't have beds or we don't have staff. So I think it's an absolute necessity in what she's doing.
How is the staff holding up there?
It's tough. You know, they're tired. This is a huge emotional drain. It's, you know, I'll tell you in just my 22 years of being in medicine, I've never seen a disease process that when it gets bad, how sick these patients become, and because they can't have family with them, you know, the nurses, the providers become those patients' social support. And so it's physically and it's emotionally draining. But we've been very lucky to have some additional support for our staff to kind of go through those emotions and deal with that right now.
Does your staff have all of the equipment that it needs at this point?
Right now we do, thankfully. We have not been in any shortage in terms of using of ventilators or our BiPAP machines, which are kind of a step before the need for a ventilator, high flow oxygen. So we've had that, and yes, the other really good news is we have the PPE that we need to be able to go in and keep ourselves safe as we care for these patients.
Let's talk about any advancements or developments in terms of treatments for people who are getting sick and being hospitalized with COVID.
So right now, I think the last time when we visited, we talked a little bit about some of the treatment protocols that we're using right now. We continue to use remdesivir, which is an antiviral agent that if you can get that on board early in the disease process, it may actually help maybe shorten that course and them getting worse. We do use convalescent plasma, which is basically putting antibodies from recovered COVID patients into our patients to help them fight the disease a little bit more. And then we use steroids as one of our other treatment plans to kind of reduce inflammation. Recently, there's been a new medication that's coming out, which is a monoclonal antibody. We heard a little bit of that, about that when the president got sick. And so now that is just been released by the FDA for emergency use authorization. And so that will be something else that will hopefully come into our arsenal to help us fight this disease.
You haven't had access to it as of yet, though.
We have not had access to it yet, but we definitely will hopefully in the coming days and hopefully not more than a couple of weeks be able to have access to that.
575-646-2212. If you have a question for Dr. Gomez today on Voice of the Public, of course, we also got some really good news, hopeful news about vaccines. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. I think everybody's been waiting anxiously for that to come through. And the one most recently through Pfizer and BioNTech, which is a German company, is they have a little bit of a different type of vaccine, what they call an mRNA vaccine, that has been shown thus far in its, the third part of their clinical trial to be highly effective, about 90% effective. And that's actually amazing to have a vaccine that could be that effective. In general, if you look at kind of the annual flu vaccine that we give, it's got about a 60% efficacy. And the FDA had said that if we had a vaccine for COVID that would be at least 50% efficacious, that they would be very excited about that. So I think everybody's anxiously hoping for this vaccine that hopefully will help us as we move forward through this pandemic and in getting it on our patients, so hopefully we don't have people getting sick. The question is still going to be how long is it effective for, and then how quickly can we get it out to the general population, because it's going to probably be allocated to certain populations at least initially.
A few weeks ago, the state was supposed to turn in its plan for disseminating the vaccine when it became available. Do you know anything about what that looks like for us?
Yeah, I think just like what's kind of been stated nationally about it, they're going to want to get it first to those that are at highest risk. And I think most people are looking at that, at least initially, for the healthcare providers. Obviously, if your healthcare providers are getting ill and they're not able to care for these patients, we want to avoid that as much as possible because then we'll have a shortage. And then from there, it's going to go to, again, those high-risk patients that would need it. So those that we know, the elderly who can get sicker and actually have a higher chance of mortality, will probably be that next lead, and those with immunosuppression. And then it will go from there. And, you know, we hear a lot about 500 million vaccines, but if you think about the U.S. overall, when there's 3 billion of us, it's not going to be this everybody available right away. It's going to have to come out in those phases to make it available to those most vulnerable.
Would you have any idea at this point, looking down the road, at when we might start to see that become available, readily available for the public?
You know, they're hoping that this is the Pfizer vaccine is going to be available by the end of this month. I would think if we look at it kind of realistically, like when we would see it here in New Mexico, we probably are looking more into December and January before it becomes available, at least for that first part of its availability.
So between now and then, we are going to have to continue social distancing and wearing masks and hand washing as vigorously as we ever have.
Absolutely. That should never stop. And even once the vaccine is rolled out and people start receiving it, we're still going to have to do that. It's not going to be that magically now the masks get to come off and we get to all get together again, and, you know, the way that we've been used to. We're still going to have to proceed with caution the way that we're doing right now.
Dr. Gomez, I think we did. I think this happened before, too. I did. The phone is breaking up just a little bit.
Oh, so. No. And I got on the handset, so I'm going to make sure everything's plugged in right.
Yeah,
try not to mess with it.
Jiggle the cables a little there. And in the meantime, I will give you the phone number again. If you have a question for Dr. Gomez on Voice of the Public today, call 575-646-2212, 646-2212. And I do want to move on to getting together because the holidays are here and Thanksgiving is not far away. We want to talk a little bit about how we can keep our families safe during the holidays. But I want to take a moment here just to give you another update from the governor's news conference today. Earlier, she did issue a shelter-in-place order for 2 weeks, beginning Monday, trips only conducted for health, safety, and welfare. Non-essential businesses and nonprofits must cease in-person activities. She explained what those essential businesses are: grocery stores, pharmacies, gas stations, shelters, child care facilities, and some retail. Restaurants may provide curbside pickup and delivery, on-site dining prohibited. Salons, gyms, and other close contact retail spaces will not be allowed to operate. So that is, as we're following along with the governor's update this week, the latest from Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham. And Dr. Dolores Gomez, the chief medical officer from Memorial Medical Center, here with us today. So let's dive into the holidays.
Yeah, well, basically just what you heard from the governor, what she's doing is what we need to continue to do. And, you know, it's tough to not to be around your families, but one of the things that I'm trying to tell my patients, and I think that what our public needs to realize, is when we talk about getting together really should be is who's in your home. Your bubble is going to be the family members that live in your household. And even though mom and dad might be live, you know, 5 minutes away from you, they're a separate household, and they probably shouldn't be coming into your home during those holidays. And we just have to learn to be a little more creative in how we get together. You know, everybody's getting better at using Zooms and doing virtual gatherings, and that's really what we need to do. And, you know, I'd like to say, you know, what we see sometimes when we get these patients that come into the hospitals, we're not just getting mom who gets sick. We're getting dad who's coming in, and brothers and sisters, and it has to do with, you know, it's hard to say let's not have a birthday for, you know, your young sibling, but we really need to just avoid that as much as possible, because we're not just having one family member get sick. We're having several, and it's due to gatherings.
Yeah. We have a caller on the line, Cressme, holding to ask a question. Good afternoon. Thank you for calling Voice of the Public, Cressme.
Yes. My question is regarding the pandemic. Is it holding up other surgeries or operations, or are they on schedule?
So good question, and that has been something that was affected very early on in the pandemic. Initially, when we needed to hold on surgeries, a lot of that was due because we were concerned about conserving PPE. Luckily, that part has been okay, but one of the things that here at our facility that we're really looking at is still looking at those need for elective cases to be done. If they are something that could wait a little bit longer, we're suggesting that, but we're not stopping elective surgeries at this point. Obviously, if there are surgeries that can come in and go home the same day, we would absolutely prefer that, because we want to keep beds available in our hospital for our sicker patients, COVID and non-COVID related. But at this point, we haven't stopped moving surgeries forward, but really having our providers think through with their patients to say, is this something that we can wait on?
Okay, that sounds good to me. I appreciate your call. I appreciate your answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Uh-huh.
And we have another caller on the line, Ray. Thank you for calling Voice of the Public this afternoon, Ray. What's your question?
Yeah. I'm curious to know. I live in Tularosa, which, as you know, is a very small village north of Alamogordo. But I am of an age that I am a high-risk individual. I'm 72. It's not as high-risk as some. But I'm kind of curious as to how those of us who are in outer areas can be serviced with a vaccine once it does become available.
That's a good question. You know, you're bringing up a really good point about the availability, and are you going to be able to get it at your smaller community locations? As the vaccine comes out, it's going to be allocated to kind of larger community areas, obviously, because you're dealing with a larger population and, again, a vulnerable population. But the Department of Health is going to be very involved as well in terms of these vaccines being allocated as well. And so I can't tell you for sure how it's going to get out to Tularosa, but I think, you know, as our counties and the state work through that to make sure that those vaccines are going to be available to all those that definitely are at higher risk.
Okie dokie. Well, let's hope they don't forget about us.
No.
I will be sure they won't.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks for calling today. 575-646-2212, the number to call on Voice of the Public if you have a question for Dr. Dolores Gomez today, the Chief Medical Officer for Memorial Medical Center. I want to talk about this story that just started circulating yesterday about a 52-year-old Las Cruces man. I think he works for City Utilities and has been in the hospital with COVID for something like 115 days. Ultimately received in Phoenix a double lung transplant and is looking at coming home and called himself a walking miracle. And I must say, I really hadn't heard of patients getting lung transplants as a result of COVID. What do you know about that situation?
Yeah, that's a pretty rare occurrence. You know, we know that part of what COVID does is it has such a profound effect on our pulmonary system, our lung system, and how those lungs work. They almost become, it's a good way to describe it, is they become like honeycombs. They just cannot take in that oxygen and help you breathe that back out, and that's a big part of it, and they fill up with fluid. And so the fact that this gentleman was able to get along as long as he did and then be able to receive that lung transplant, I think, is definitely a rarity, and we won't see that often. I think, unfortunately, most patients succumb to the to the disease process and kind of the organ failure that happens. So I think it's wonderful to hear that. I mean, it's definitely a success story. It's just I don't think we're going to see it all that often because, again, organ transplant in general is always very difficult to do. But in this situation, I think he was probably very fortunate to be in the right place and be able to receive that.
As we're hearing news coming out of the governor's weekly update, shelter-in-place order, non-essential businesses closed for 2 weeks beginning Monday. There was a study that was published in the journal Nature this week. It used cell phone data to track the hourly movements of some 98 million people from 57,000 neighborhoods to points of interest, like restaurants and churches and stores. They did it beginning in March for 2 months and came out with some 80% of infections tracking back to full-service restaurants, gyms, hotels, religious organizations, cafes, and limited-service restaurants. So for people who are wondering, you know, where is the risk? We're seeing more science all of the time about where the risk is. What do you have to say in terms of places people are going and the risk that they're exposing themselves to?
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up. I read that article as well, and I actually had some talking points on it. So
great.
We must be on the same vibe somewhere. But exactly what you're saying is in locations where, again, we're in enclosed spaces where we can put more of us within those areas like restaurants, gyms, cafes, hotels, just like you described, you know, it increases our risk because we aren't, there's ventilation, but the ventilation is less. We're in an enclosed space, and so that increases your exposure risk. Definitely. But it's interesting in that study, they said if you even can decrease that maximum occupancy, and you can actually reduce that infection rate because, again, you have less people in there, you have less people in an enclosed space. It's just unfortunate that that's been very difficult for us to do. And you know, again, why the governor at this point is saying we just need to stop anybody being able to gather anywhere because we have to get control right now of our infection rate.
646-2212, the number to call if you have a question for Dr. Gomez. Things have been increasing exponentially, not just around the state of New Mexico, but nationwide. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in El Paso right now and the explosion of cases there and the situation that their medical community is in.
Yeah, El Paso has become kind of a national news right now because they are such a hot spot right now. And it's, you know, it's because it's so close to us, you know, it does put us at a vulnerable situation as well because there is a lot of travel between Las Cruces and El Paso. People work in both locations and they bilocate. But it's amazing. They recently had a report out that they have had approximately as of today, I think 751 COVID deaths in El Paso County in the last 8 months. And to put that in perspective, in the last 13 years, if you compare it to the flu, there have been 200 deaths from the flu in 13 years compared to 750 deaths in the last 8 months from COVID. You know, so it kind of puts that seriousness again back in this disease. You know, it's never fun to have to see it now face to face. It sometimes makes it a little less real when you're hearing about it in New York and other places. Mm-hmm. But it's just down the backyard from us right now, and everybody really needs to take this as serious as possible and anything and everything that we can do to help slow down this spread is what we need to do right now.
A lot of people are asking with that movement between communities, and I'm guilty here, but there are people, they see people with Texas plates in the line for COVID testing, and people wonder if people come from El Paso to Las Cruces to get a COVID test, does that COVID positive, if they are positive, get recorded in New Mexico or in El Paso?
No, it should be recorded in the person's residence. So even though they're coming here, you know, one of the things that the Department of Health has done a really good job of is they, you know, they want to be able to track the actual address or the location of these people, and they often will do it by phones as well. So if they're coming from El Paso but they're getting the test here, it should still be registered in the county that person is from.
All right. 575-646-2212, the telephone number to call with your question for Dr. Gomez this afternoon on Voice of the Public. We appreciate you listening, following along on Facebook as well. Chuck Cody is on Facebook and posted for us something interesting from Business Insider about a spike in coronavirus cases soon after the initial stimulus efforts were exhausted. I wonder if that looks like, well, it was a combination of things getting stalled, of course, in Congress, but also there were reopenings all over the country, so people went back to work. And so it kind of makes sense that we would see all of those factors come together at the same time. Would we be seeing a wave like this, regardless of what stimulus was happening or what openings were happening, do you think?
You know, I my opinion is I think we probably would still see it. I think we've been talking very early on in the pandemic that everyone was a little bit worried as the weather got cooler. And what happens when the weather gets cooler? We tend to go indoors. And we already know that being indoors increases our risk of exposure. And so I think everybody was very concerned that as the fall and the winter months came, that we were going to see this second surge that everybody, you know, has been talking about within communities. And I think in the summer, because things were going very well for us overall, I think, again, we got a little bit of COVID fatigue. You know, I think we're okay. I feel good. I can be outdoors. Let's have a picnic and let's invite, you know, a few people over. So I think we all got a little tired as well. And I think that's also contributing to it.
No doubt. 575-646-2212. And Mary is on the line with a question for Dr. Gomez. Good afternoon, Mary.
How are you? My question is about the testing itself. Are we using rapid testing, or are there a variety of tests going on and how long they're taking to get results?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. So actually there are a variety of tests, and depending on where you get tested may be what they use. There are rapid tests that can be either an antigen test or it can be what we call a PCR test, where you kind of amplify the DNA to see if you have a virus present or not. And so those are the most common. Some, in order to get the result back, is going to take about 48 hours for those results to come back. Those are often a lot of our PCR tests that we have. The rapid tests are the antigen tests that you'll see. So in our emergency room, we're using those rapid tests for our symptomatic patients when they walk through the door because it tends to be a better test when your pre-test probability of somebody truly having the disease, is it going to be positive in that test when you actually get it? So the tests are still taking some time, especially those that get sent out. Most of those are PCR tests, so that's a tough part. And because more people are getting tests, there can be a little bit of a backlog, and so the tests take a little bit longer. But with the tests and the rapid test, I still tell everybody that test is only as good as at that point in time that you get it. And especially if you're asymptomatic, the test result may not truly pick up if you're truly positive at that point in time. So we still have to do our due diligence again to quarantine ourselves if we think we've been exposed. If we start to develop symptoms, you may need to retest. But it is a variety of different tests, and depending on where you're going, maybe a good question to ask, like, what kind of test am I getting and how long is this going to take?
Yeah, really. We're seeing a lot of those rapid tests. They seem to be more unreliable than the traditional nasal swab, right, that we would get. And people seem to be getting, you know, more mixed results with the rapid tests. Would you recommend that we just avoid those altogether?
No, I think the rapid test has its place, and I think really the best place where that rapid test is good is when you have symptoms, you're meeting those criteria that I think I could have COVID. Mm. That's when that test is the best. That's when our viral load tends to be higher, and that's when that antigen is going to be picked up by that rapid test.
Gotcha.
It's really hard to say where is that if I don't have symptoms. So if I got exposed yesterday and I go get tested today, more than likely, that test is going to be negative.
I see. Thank you. 646-2212 to ask Dr. Gomez a question on Voice of the Public this afternoon on KRWG. Thank you so much for joining us. Mary, another Mary on the line with a question. Good afternoon.
Good Good afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Gomez, for being available for these questions. I had two questions. One of them is about contact tracing. Is there electronic contact tracing going on? And the other question I had was about when our hospitals fill up, is there a plan for what to do with the patients?
Oh, very good questions. The first one, I can't tell you for sure if we are doing electronic contact tracing. The Department of Health has been doing that a lot by phone calls, and they're doing that rapid response, especially when outbreaks are happening in certain businesses as well. I think that once they know that, there may be that electronic ability, but I think most of it is being done by phones, by interviews, and that. So the Department of Health could probably give you more specifics on that for sure. As far as what's going to happen if we reach capacity, absolutely. We have a group of leaders within the hospital that get together every day, and we develop what we call a surge plan. So what's going to happen if our ICU beds get full? What's going to happen if we don't have staff to take care of these patients? You know, where's the next step that these patients go? So we're doing that, and we're doing that also as a community involvement as well, because if we have a patient who maybe isn't as ill, maybe can't take up a hospital bed, our outlying community providers are really looking at how maybe we can do telehealth visits for those and have very frequent calls with them, so maybe we can still take care of them outside of the hospital but still ensure that they're getting quality care when that's happening. So we have that in place, and it may change depending on what happens, but definitely Memorial is preparing for that, and we're working with our colleagues at Mountain View as well and Three Crosses, who have only been open for a short time, but really making sure that we're working together as a community to serve our patients.
All right. Thank you very much, Mary. Let's go to Ray, who is holding with a question for Dr. Gomez. Good afternoon, Ray. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a question to the doctor. Is one of the symptoms of COVID upset stomach and diarrhea, strong diarrhea?
Mm-hmm. So it's not one of the more common symptoms, but absolutely, we do list some of those GI symptoms as also a possibility for COVID. You know, the more common symptoms that we talk about, fever, headache, shortness of breath, cough, and kind of one of the big key ones that really seems to go a lot with COVID specifically is that loss of taste and smell. We don't tend to see that very often in the flu or even just kind of the common cold. But some people will present with other just kind of more vague symptoms, and that does include some nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea as well. So if you think you've been exposed and there's a possibility of that and those are your symptoms, you may still want to consider quarantining and deciding about talking with your healthcare provider if you should be tested.
Yeah, and follow up. My wife was coughing, short coughs for a long time. Is that what you're referring, coughing?
Yeah, it can be a cough. Now the other tough part, too, where we're kind of getting a little bit past allergy season, but sometimes, you know, people can have coughs for other reason. But if it's associated with other symptoms, again, if you're having fever or anything else, and you think you may have been exposed, and, of course, right now, because we have such large community spread, you could be exposed very easily no matter where you are unless you're just staying home. It's always worth having that conversation with your provider to decide should we do something else.
And what stage do we take the patient to the hospital? Why do they take patients to the hospital? Is that because they can't breathe and they need respirator?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, sometimes just feeling a little under the weather, maybe having a mild fever, you know, we think we can manage ourselves at home. But some of those kind of emergency symptoms that we always want to think about is if I cannot catch my breath, if I try to get up out of bed and I can't take five steps forward without having to stop for breathing, if I'm speaking in very short sentences, if you have the ability to check your oxygen at home and you're dropping below 90% on that pulse oximeter, those are all reasons to get to the hospital.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care of yourselves. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Okay, and Libby is holding as well with a question for Dr. Gomez. Welcome to Voice of the Public, Libby. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for hosting. Dr. Gomez, I am wondering if a person has tested positive and had to be out of work, should a second test be performed before they come back if they're still feeling a little under the weather, or should they just take the precautions with the PPE that they're provided with?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you for that. So actually, the really good thing about that recovery period after COVID, CDC has really laid out some good guidelines. Initially, we thought getting that test to prove that you're now negative and maybe now less infectious was a good idea. But again, as we talked a little bit earlier, the tests aren't necessarily 100%. And so we have found people still remaining positive on their test weeks, 5, 6, 7 weeks out after being infected. So the way the CDC has laid it out now is if you have had symptoms of COVID, you have about a 10-day from the start of symptoms of when we now feel that you may be non-infectious, but you also should be no fever for 24 hours, and your symptoms should be improving, and that includes the cough. Now, you still need to wear your PPE when you get back to work. You need to wear your mask, continue to do your hand hygiene. But now it's more of a time-based recovery rather than a negative test need.
Thank you, Dr. Gomez.
Thank you, Libby, for calling 575-646-2212, the telephone number to ask Dr. Gomez a question. She is the chief medical officer at Memorial Medical Center. And you mentioned continuing to wear your mask. We did see some good news about the efficacy of masks this week as well, how they not only protect others, but seem to be protecting us too.
Yeah, absolutely. The mask, why masks had to become a controversy, I'm not quite sure. But definitely, initially, as we were learning about the disease, was could a mask make a difference? And initially, we thought, well, we don't know if it does or not. But now the data is really supporting that wearing that mask can make a difference. It keeps me from exposing somebody to something I may have, but also in the other direction. If they happen to have something and they don't have their mask, my mask is going to be protective to me as well. So it's good news that we continue to do that, and hopefully it may bring some good news as we start to hit flu season, that maybe we won't see flu be as bad because we all are continuing to wear our masks through this pandemic.
That is something that I believe we saw in the Southern Hemisphere, right?
Yes, correct. I think, long before any of this has gone on, if we look at some of our Asian countries as well, they often wear masks just in general. And so there may be something to us just kind of helping slow spread of contagious diseases. And so we can only be hopeful that maybe our flu season may be a little bit more mild as we try to get through COVID through the winter months.
The mitigation efforts would help keep us from getting the flu too.
Yes, absolutely.
But flu shots, still highly recommended.
Yes. I don't expect that the mask is going to do it all for you, because, you know, at some point our masks come off when we get home, and there's always still risk of spreading those little germs around. So, yes, if you can get your flu shot and you haven't, please get to your doctor. Please get to some of those pharmacies that offer those flu shots.
A few weeks ago, we had our first case of influenza in southeast New Mexico, a teenager, I believe. Or a very young person who came down with influenza. Any word on, recent numbers in terms of flu in New Mexico? Is it spreading at all? Or?
Yeah, we're starting to see a few cases, but we're not at the point yet. You know, every year our Department of Health, and they are super busy right now, but that is still something we're tracking. And when we hit a certain number of cases in a community is when they say we know that we really need to hunker down and do all those mitigation practices. But thus far, our flu cases are still staying fairly low, and hopefully that can stay that way as we continue to fight through COVID.
Right. We do have some callers on the line, so let's get to Ida, who has a question for us on Voice of the Public this afternoon. Good afternoon, Ida. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Hi, doctor. I had a question as far as my daughter had tested positive back in July. She's doing a lot better, thank God. My question is, can you get COVID more than once?
That's a great question. So we have had cases of people who have had COVID and have seemed to have recovered and then will develop symptoms later on again and get retested and be positive as well. So we have had a very few cases of that happening. Now, the other difficult thing with COVID is some people, if you've heard the term of what they call long haulers, where they've been sick, they get better from kind of the real acute piece, but they still continue to have these just kind of lingering symptoms where maybe they continue to have some shortness of breath. So it's really difficult to say, did they totally recover or do they just experiencing these continued symptoms? But we have had a few cases of that, yes, that people can still maybe get reinfected with COVID.
So what this means is continue the social distancing and the mask wearing, even if you've had it. Don't think that makes you immune.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because my daughter does have, like you mentioned, she still has some symptoms. Of course, it's not like how she was when she got sick. My other question, doctor, I had tested positive for influenza B about 2 months ago. I was told, I don't know if it's so much true, that when you get the influenza B, more than likely you won't be getting, it's hard for you to get the COVID as well. Is that any true to that?
You know, I wish I could say that there's some truth to that, but I don't think that there's any protection by having flu that it's going to prevent you from getting COVID. They're both separate viruses altogether, and so I don't think there's any extra protection if you've had one virus that it's going to protect you from another. So unfortunately, keep being safe, keep using your mask, keep washing your hands, and do everything just to keep yourself safe.
Yeah, because the influenza B was pretty tough. I can't imagine the COVID. Thank you so much.
Oh,
Dr.
Yes.
I appreciate you.
Thank
You're
you,
very
Ida.
Welcome.
Stay safe, and thanks for calling. And now we go to Etta, who is holding with a question for Dr. Gomez. Good afternoon, Etta. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you? Good. Thank you. I wanted to know whether or not the testing is covered by Medicare.
So, yes, I'll say the simple answer is yes. You know, there are still sometimes some processing fees depending on where you're getting the tests done. You know, before through the Department of Health, they have always said, and the governor has always said, if you need a test, the test will be there for you and the test is free. That had even been said nationally that would happen. But now that there are so many other tests and locations that are doing as well, there may be some charges that you may see, but the test itself should and continue to remain free.
I expect to be traveling, and I need to have a test done 72 hours before I travel and get the results back. And I've called several places, and they want outrageous fees, and that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, that's a tough. I know a lot of, again, in order to meet that criteria, and a lot of people are having this because, you know, they're trying to travel to get places because it's necessary. Hopefully it's necessary that you have to travel. But the only way to kind of meet that criteria would be to do that rapid test. And again, some places that are offering rapid tests are often going to be places like urgent cares. And so the fee and the cost behind that is often more because of the facility that you're going to, not necessarily just the test in and of itself. So those are difficult situations in being able to get that test done because it's being required right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck to you. Thank you for calling, Etta. And 646-2212, the telephone number for the time we have left, which is just a little over 12 minutes here for Voice of the Public this afternoon with Dr. Dolores Gomez, the Chief Medical Officer at Memorial Medical Center. Bob is next on the line. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Gomez, a question about the Pfizer, I guess, BioNTech flu that is getting talked about with 90% effectivity. As I understand it, and I've read this in a real paper, that of the 94 people, the volunteers that were injected with for the test, 86 of them were given the placebo, which means that 8 of them actually got the vaccine. So even if 7 of the 8 got the vaccine, sure, that's 90%. But is that really a way to ensure the efficacy of a vaccine like this, because out of 8 people, 7 got better? It just seems like it's a very low number. Or is there more testing to be done?
Yeah. So I'm not 100% sure when you're talking about the numbers you have. The trial that they enrolled 43,000 volunteers. So in order to get to that phase three trial, you have to have at least 30,000 people enrolled in order to see how that vaccine works. And who's going to respond to it. So the 90 people, you know, there might have been in one small piece of the study, but they've had over 40,000 volunteers who have received the vaccine, and it's a two-dose vaccine as well. So, you know, again, it's really looking at it from that larger phase trial, because that you want numbers, obviously. A small number isn't going to equal what you need it to be, and you're right, 7 out of 8 is going to get you close to that 90%. You wanted to see it in a large volume of patients, and right. And my understanding of that is that they have done that, and that's where they're seeing how efficacious it is.
Gotcha. I just say because apparently on the 9th of November is when they announced this fantastic development, but it seemed like a little bit advanced. But if they got 30,000 other people and we'll wait a few weeks, that's fine.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You're welcome.
And a thank you to all of those people who offered themselves up as volunteers, knowing that many of them would, in fact, get COVID.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you know, you have to have your ones that get the vaccine and then the half of the other ones that don't get the vaccine. And so there's always those risks. But definitely promising that in those that did receive the vaccine, they did get that close to that 90% efficacy.
Yeah. All right. Got Ed on the line next with a question for Dr. Gomez. Good afternoon, Ed. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. Doctor, ladies, question, please. When my wife was alive, she passed away with IPF, and I was her sole caregiver. Does that put me in a higher risk?
Because of her disease process, are you at risk?
Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. Well, it really shouldn't. You know, IPF, I'm assuming you're talking about idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, if I'm getting your abbreviation correct.
Pardon me for interrupting, but thank you for that, because I had no idea. And even after you said what that stood for, I might still have no idea. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So basically, it's like building up scar tissue in your lungs. And so when that happens, again, those lungs just become stiff rather than nice and pliable to be able to breathe. You know, and the I part of it, the idiopathic, is, again, sometimes we don't know what causes it. The thing is it's not something that is often spreadable. So unless, sir, you have some underlying conditions, including something like COPD, which is more common that you hear, or emphysema that people will talk about, diabetes, right, high blood pressure, obesity, unfortunately. And again, as we get older, we know that that increases our risk because our immune system kind of gets a little bit suppressed. So if you have those, that would be more likely a cause for you to be at greater risk rather than you being that sole caregiver for your wife. And bless your heart that you were able to do that for her. But again, as we get older, and if you have any of those comorbid conditions, that's what usually puts you at risk for exposure and infection.
Knock on wood, so far, so good. I mean, I'm in perfect health, and I don't even take a blood pressure medicine. So,
that's great. That's awesome, and you just keep being safe and doing all those things that we keep talking about, that if you have to leave your house, make sure you have your mask on, make sure you're washing your hands.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. We appreciate your phone call. It is 1:52, so we just have a few minutes left for anybody who has a question for Dr. Gomez with the time we have left here on Voice of the Public. I just want to remind you that if you're just joining us, we have been following along with the governor's update this week, and we are now under a shelter-in-place order for the next 2 weeks, beginning Monday. Trips only conducted for health, safety, and welfare. All non-essential businesses and nonprofits must cease in-person activities. She also says in a statement, the state health officials, I should say, altogether, say the state has developed a tiered county-by-county system that will be used to establish reopening benchmarks for each county upon the November 30th expiration of the new emergency public health order. So state health officials and modeling advisors are readying a system for implementation which would permit counties the flexibility to engage in more in-person and business activities with Department of Health approval when they are able to drive down infection rates and prevent community outbreaks. They also have listed a civil administrative penalty of up to $5,000 a day for violations of the Public Health Emergency Response Act. So just wanted to make sure everybody is up to date there. Dr. Gomez, have you seen people coming from other counties where there aren't adequate where there isn't adequate hospital capacity into Doñana County at this point?
Yeah, we have, and sometimes it's not so much that the hospital doesn't have capacity, but I don't know if they have the services available or the providers available to give the care to these patients. Both Memorial and Mountain View are both kind of what we call hubs for the southern part of the state. So some of the smaller community outlying hospitals are sending patients to us to care for them, especially those that are going to need ICU care. Those are the ones that are going to need those extra specialty services. They're going to need that equipment, and that's something that both Memorial and Mountain View can provide. So we are seeing them coming from outlying communities as well. And the tough part with that, too, is given that some of our larger hospitals around us, including in El Paso and even going up north to Albuquerque, they're reaching their capacity limits. So it's putting us in that vulnerable position that we're going to have to be those accepting locations for these small communities. And so we want to try to do everything we can to get patients in, get them well, but we want those patients not have to come in and see us at all and not get sick. So just staying vigilant in taking care of ourselves.
All right, let's go to Ronald, who is holding with a question for us this afternoon. Hi, Ronald.
Good afternoon. How are you all doing?
Doing well.
Doing well.
My question is, in the absolute worst-case scenarios, when cases overrun the hospital, the hospital staffing, beds, will the military be called in terms of the state National Guard? You often see scenarios like this in Hollywood fictitious films. The one that comes to mind is Outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the... Is there any such plan like that, either on the national level, certainly on the local state level, to refer to the National Guard to help out with the staffing problem?
Yes, sir. You know, I would love to say that you only have to see that in Hollywood movies, but that is happening currently in El Paso, where they are having to bring in the National Guard to help them to care for those patients. Once a state declares an emergency disaster, then that's when a lot of times we rely on somebody like the National Guard to help us. And that actually did happen up in the northwest part of the state earlier during the pandemic, during the beginning of the summer months, where our National Guard was up there and helping. So yes, our state is prepared to do that. If we reach that point, I'm sure our governor is paying attention, and part of why she's doing what she's doing right now in order to hopefully help prevent us to go to that level. But we are seeing that happening nationally, and we're just seeing it in El Paso right now.
Thank you very much, Doctor. That was a concern to me because it sounds a bit of a panic when healthcare workers are inflicted.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what we continue to try to do. We got to keep our healthcare employees as well as possible because we have to keep caring for you.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you.
Enjoy your week.
Thank you very much, Ronald. With just the couple of minutes we have left, Dr. Gomez, how are you? How is your family doing, and how are you weathering this storm?
Well, I think I'm doing well right now. You know, I have my certain days. Sometimes it's hard to come in and see the numbers that we see, and unfortunately see see as many people get as sick and go through this. But we have such a great team here. We're very lucky in our facility to have a palliative care team that helps us have conversations with patients very early on or when they're kind of reaching a point where we know we can't do much else for them to help us a lot. And I'm very lucky that my husband is also in the medical field, so he understands what I'm going through, and he's living it too as well. But we just try to stay as safe as we can. My kids are also spokespersons for being vigilant and taking care of themselves, and they tell us every day we get home, you go change your clothes and you wash your hands, and they're keeping us on track as well. So I'm doing well, fortunately, and I hope to continue to be that way, and I hope our community also does the same, and I just want them to know that our hospital is here to do what we can for them, but we need their help. We need them to do everything they can. Please, please, please stay home. Don't be out and about. Wear your mask if you have to be out, but only go out when you have to.
Do you expect that these orders will help us get this thing under control?
I think if our community understands this public health crisis that we're having right now, and that we come together as a community and understand why this is so important, not only for them not to get ill, but to help us in the hospital, be able to do our jobs, not be so fatigued that we can't take care of them, I think that we can come together as a community. I think Las Cruces is wonderful in that aspect, that we will do what's being said, and I think it will help make a change.
How much cooperation is there between Las Cruces and El Paso in terms of this crisis?
There's been a lot of communication since the pandemic happened, and fortunately for El Paso, and I guess for us as well, through all of this, they said, you know, we're going to do what we need to do, and we're going to rely on our state to help us. So they're not anticipating having to send us any overflow from them. They have what they need through the state to do that, and that will be helpful for us as we continue to see kind of these increased numbers for us as well. But I would love to say that if we start to get too full, are we going to be able to rely on El Paso? That might be difficult given where their numbers are right now.
Yeah, sure seems that way. Well, I'll say it now. Happy new normal holidays, Dr. Gomez, and thank you so much for joining us today.
To you too, Casey, and please stay safe.
All right. And I also want to say thank you to engineers Jacob Lockwood and Anthony Porras for their help today and every voice of the public, and to Fred Martino for keeping us updated on the news coming out of the Governor's Weekly Update. Up next, it's Intermezzo by request. Leora Zeitlin, right after NPR News. Thanks for joining us.